Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio as we reach around the world. Hello to our listeners in Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England, Papua New Guinea, the Philippines, all across North America, and especially Los Angeles, California, where we have such a massive group of people that tune in each week. We'd also like to thank Melissa Hovey, our studio producer, Wayne Larson, our technical engineer. Music tonight was done by Jim Johnson. We're so thrilled tonight as our guest, Harvey Kubernick. I guess you would call him rock and roll writer extraordinaire, written for such magazines as the Rolling Stone, so it's going to be rock and roll tonight. And from his massive Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and always prompt, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson. Should be a pretty good show tonight with Harvey back.
It will be a great show. We always enjoy having Harvey on, and it's always a thrill to talk to him.
Hey, has it cooled off at your place yet?
Oh, yeah. I think it's gotten down to 90.
Yeah, that's about what we are here in Indianapolis.
It is sweltering. That's all I can say. It's been quite warm. And, you know, the animals, they've got the answer. They find the shade, and they sleep all day. So they're the smart guys.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. This half of the Wild World is brought to you by We Want You Cottages in Chautauqua Lake, New York. Almost forgot that. Peter Weimer and his wife, Kathy, they have an extraordinary cottage and lodge on the banks of Lake Chautauqua. We totally recommend all of our listeners to head up to Western New York. Great fishing, muskie, pike, smallmouth bass, perch, it's all there. Go to the website, www.wewantyou.com, and find out the fantastic rates they offer. They also have just put in a massive swimming pool, indoor swimming pool, by the way. That's quite extraordinary. I'll tell you, we've stayed there before. It's absolutely phenomenal. And, of course, they were the host for the Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo. And go to their website, ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. They make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with your Wild World News for July 18th. Now, Larry, here's a good idea for your bears, I think.
Oh.
Let's start out in Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. Now, the brown bears are getting ready for their close-ups. Explore.org has, again, set up live high-definition webcams from the remote Alaskan park. Now what they're going to do is basically give you a front row seat to the lives of the bears. You can sit in front of your computer and watch them.
Oh, cool.
They've got 8-cam webcams set up, which offer views of the bears as they catch fish. And as we know, they're trying to get fattened up before winter arrives.
You know, and winter in Alaska is not too far away.
That's right.
My goodness. That's pretty cool. Is there an official website given?
Yeah, just all you need is explore.org.
Okay, cool.
And you can watch the bears. Now, I've watched your bears before. They are pretty entertaining.
That they are, I'll have to tell you. But I also have to tell you, when the weather's hot like this, they don't do nothing. I mean, we get the hose going. We hose them down real good on these 90-degree days, but after they finish with their bath, they're back to bed. So,
you've done that to me before.
I know, but you're not supposed to tell anybody.
Oh, yeah, sorry. All right, let's head off to Atlanta, Georgia. Now, this is good news. The first twin pandas born in the United States since 1987 had their homecoming, or their outcoming, their coming out party this Tuesday at Zoo Atlantis. Now, the giant panda Lun Lun gave birth to the pair Monday.
I saw pictures.
Twin pandas, they're pretty cute.
They are pretty cute, and it's hard to believe how small they are,
what they grow into.
That's what
I was thinking, too, yeah. Yeah, they're so small when they're born. And
I wonder what Dave Davies would say about that.
Well, Larry, you know, the pandas, they're kind of on the endangered species list, and then when they're born, it's better to have more of them, you know, two more, rather than one.
It doesn't get any better.
All right, well, tonight... Tonight we have got a double creature feature. Why is that? Topeka, Kansas. An endangered species of monkey has given birth to twins, again, at the Topeka Zoo.
Oh.
Yeah, Devra, a three-year-old golden lion tamarin, gave birth Wednesday. Now, she and the baby's father, Charlie, arrived in Topeka as part of the golden lion tamarin species survival plan.
Do you know where they're from for $50, Dr. Day?
Well, the golden tamarins are native to Brazil.
Oh, yes.
And they live in the coastal rainforest there. And they have been threatened by habitat destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And the bad thing was, in the early 70s, there were only like 200 left in the wild.
Wow.
Yeah. So we got another set of twins, which is a really special thing.
That's very cool.
That's the double creature feature.
Oh, my.
All right, what's cooking in Arlington, Virginia?
Not a clue.
Well, a snake that slithered into some electrical equipment caused a power outage for 10,000 customers.
My gosh. 10,000?
Yep.
Lord have mercy. You know, I have a bumper sticker on the back of my truck that says, "I break for snakes."
That's right.
And you wouldn't believe the dirty looks I get.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that just aren't fond of snakes.
No, that's so true.
But we like them.
Their public relations department is so poor, I mean.
Yeah.
They need Harvey Kubernick to handle a snake.
I think that's a great idea.
He'd find a positive
okay.
light about it.
All right, we're going to call this next story Up the River Without a Paddle. Four men were sentenced to 1 year of probation for illegally transporting paddlefish eggs.
Oh, them suckers.
Yeah. Now, if you're not familiar with the paddlefish, you need to have a view because they're pretty interesting creatures. They're somewhat shark-like. They're freshwater fish who are considered by some to be a more available and affordable alternative to caviar.
Oh, well.
So,
too bad.
Yeah, that's the poor man's caviar.
They're the strangest looking fish you'll ever see.
Yeah. Yeah, if you've never seen one in person, you must see them.
Yeah, they're wild looking.
All right, now for all you folks, y'all folks living in the southern states, I want you to get ready and watch out for the crazy ants. Have you heard about the crazy ants?
I have not.
Well, the crazy ants have been named for their zigzagging frenzy swarms. And they're from South America, and the invaders can grow so thick in air conditioners that they short-circuit the electronics.
Oh.
Yes, they're finding them all over the southern states now. Now, they cause almost $150 million a year in electrical damage.
Whoa.
Yeah, see, they'll... When it's cold outside, they'll crawl into air conditioning units or whatever. When it's when it's cold outside, they'll crawl into outside sockets, you know, fuse boxes, whatever. And they're only about an eighth of an inch long.
My goodness!
But there are so many of them, they just eventually, when they fill up a little space, they short circuit the wiring.
You know, people that live in the South, they just do not get a break between the weather. The ants, and you know they have a termite down there, Dr. Day, that will go under your wall and literally work like five times as fast as the termite that's found in the Midwest. Hello?
Yeah, we need to breed those.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yes, it is, but it, yeah.
Now, these little crazy ants, they don't have any stingers, but they do bite.
Oh, good.
So, and they're having a really hard time controlling them there. So they came up from South America, kind of stowed away, and they're here to stay.
Darn.
All right, local news. Indiana Department of Natural Resources wildlife biologists say they have placed bans on a record 44 peregrine falcon chicks at 50 different nesting sites this spring.
Fantastic.
Now, as we know, the peregrine falcons became endangered decades ago because of pesticides.
Right.
Now, they're doing so well here now that they're waiting to see if they want to take it off of Indiana's endangered species list.
Well, I don't know about that, but you know what the pesticides would do is when they lay their eggs, they'd have a thinner shell. It happened to bald eagles, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the shell would get brittle, and they would accidentally break it.
Yep.
Well, that's good news for the peregrines, but bad news for the pigeons.
Yeah.
All right, before we go to the wild world facts tonight, it's been pretty hot around here, but it gets so hot in Death Valley that you can fry an egg.
I've heard that.
Here's the problem, yeah. That's what one of Death Valley's National Park employees did last week. She took a frying pan to the pavement, fried an egg, and posted it online. Well, guess what happened?
I don't know.
Well, all the park visitors that came to the park, well, they wanted to do the same thing. But they didn't use skillets. So.
They just did it on the pavement?
They did it on the pavement. So.
Oh.
All over Death Valley, there were gooey messes of eggs frying.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, it was such a problem that the park issued a plea on its Facebook page to crack down on the egg frying. Yeah.
You should apologize to everybody for that one.
Oh, I will sometime.
Okay.
All right, well, let's get into the wild world news so we can get Harvey on.
Yeah.
Get into the wild world facts of the day.
You're good.
Louisiana is known as the crawfish capital of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The average lifespan of a lobster is, believe it or not, 50 to 70 years.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
It is.
Now, while on a hunting expedition in Sharkey County, Mississippi, President Theodore Teddy Roosevelt refused to shoot a captured bear. And you know what happened?
What?
This act resulted in the creation of the world-famous teddy bear.
Oh, I didn't know that was why.
That's where the teddy bear came from.
God love him.
Now, the Amazon River pushes so much water into the Atlantic that more than 100 miles out to sea off the mouth of the river, one can dip fresh water out of the ocean and drink it.
You're kidding.
That's impressive, isn't it?
That is impressive.
Well, I tell you what, that's the wild world news for July 18th.
Well, once again, a masterful job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana. We want to remind everyone, check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tells all about our wildlife rescue work that we do, also our wildlife education programs. And you hope you're sitting down. We have an official Facebook page, Larry Batson's Wild World. We encourage everyone to go to the page, like the page, and you'll hear all the latest news regarding our blog talk show that's on live every Thursday night at 10 p.m., but can be downloaded forever. So we encourage you to go back to some of our past shows you may have missed because we've had some dandies.
We sure have.
Yep, and tonight's going to be a dandy as well. And your contributions make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. the way to kick off the show tonight. Our guest, all the way from Los Angeles, California, our rock and roll friend, writer for such great magazines as Rolling Stone, also a contributor to this show, providing us with wonderful guests, our good friend, Harvey Kubernick's with us tonight. Good evening, Harvey.
Good evening, Larry, in the home office in Indiana.
How are you doing?
And speaking of animals,
yes.
You know, your Colts, by the way.
Oh,
pretty good
Colts.
Football team.
We hope. It looks very
well,
promising.
Well, as I told you a year ago, you were bringing in a quarterback from Stanford. It's worked out pretty well.
He has, and I think one of the ESPN polls had put him in the top 10 quarterbacks in the NFL.
And 25 years ago, Reggie Miller from UCLA kind of helped your basketball team out pretty well, too.
Oh, did he ever. Especially one particular game against the New York Knicks in Madison Square Gardens, where he scored 9 points and 15 seconds to win the game.
I just like always showing how the West Coast just sort of bails everybody out, but I'm delighted to be here. How are you?
Well, we're great, and it's always a
Thanks.
Pleasure to have you on the show. He's our big rock and roll connection, Dr. Day, you know.
I know.
Well,
and we respect him highly.
Oh, we absolutely do. Now, you do contribute to Rolling Stone magazine.
Oh, so long ago, but I work a lot for a magazine called Record Collector News. I'm the contributing
sure.
editor of something called Treats Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff's sort of around the books that somehow are being, you know, generated and published. But
sure.
it's just sort of all writing, you know, and as Diane Sawyer said, good reporting happens when there's a great connection. So I'd like to think there's a connection, you know, when we talk or when I, you know, do articles and stuff. The name of the game is to connect with people. I mean, I know I'm doing that.
Sure. Oh, you absolutely are. And also, I am quite jealous because you had a chance to see them, I think it was last month, them Rolling Stones. Do they still have it, Harvey?
I don't care what anybody says about the Rolling Stones and their tickets cost too much and they're 69 years old. Those people don't go to the shows. There were moments where they were just as great as they've always been.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to three shows on the West Coast. I mean, maybe my viewpoint's a little, I don't know if the word is called, skewed.
Yeah.
I mean, and by the way, I've been seeing the band since the late 60s.
Sure.
Most of the time I pay for tickets like anybody else, but being in this rock and roll music racket for a few decades, you know, I occasionally get, you know, press, media, you know, radio tickets. And then I actually know Charlie Watts, the drummer of the Stones, and he invited me to see one show. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, the economics did not really impact me on this tour, besides all the driving, the schlepping, the parking, you know, total everything out where just to go see a gig, you know what I mean? You need to take out a mortgage.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
Just really inspiring, and it was very... just, you know, really, really happy the band exists and still continues to deliver on stage. That's all I can say about that one.
Oh, you know, and that's amazing to think that those guys are 90% there. Well, the only ones they've lost is Brian and
Bill Wyman.
Oh, Bill Wyman.
It was nice to see, you know, and it was nice to see Mick Taylor. You know, join the band for a few songs, like from, you know, Sticky Fingers or Let It Bleed album. And I'm not saying it was not like a Lynyrd Skynyrd guitar army on stage, but there was like three guitars going, and I hadn't seen that ever with the Rolling Stones. And Charlie was just slamming, and it just sort of all worked. And in one of the shows, my brother and I sat behind John Mayall. It was just really cool to talk to him. And it was just a really good couple evenings of just tremendous music and just something that I just kind of needed just for, you know, survival or creativity, or maybe both things bleed into each other. I don't know.
Well, sure they do. I can remember watching an old tour when Mick Taylor had just joined the band, And he's an extraordinary musician, but he just had the idea that he just didn't quite fit in with the Rolling Stones.
You know, I talked to him about that because I had seen him in 1968 as a teenager at the Whiskey a Go-Go out in Hollywood and in a place in Pasadena, California called the Rose Palace. And listen, he had joined the Stones at age 19
mm-hmm.
in 1969. And honestly, you think about joining a world-class band in the late 60s at age 19 on a wage. I mean, you're really not equipped for a lot of this stuff.
No.
But I will tell you, you know, he played great then on the 69 tour, and he was really blistering on the 72 tour. And the numbers that I saw him play in L.A.,
I'll bet.
A couple of months ago, I mean, and it is interesting to talk to somebody who you meet in the late 60s, and then in year 2013 you have a brief chat with them, and I kind of said to myself, you know, if I'm still seeing the Stones and Mick Taylor's, you know, in downtown L.A. with me, then that's a really good thing. I mean,
absolutely.
We're both in the music.
Yeah,
we don't promote the music. We are the music.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was just really good. We had some mutual friends, and he got a big kick about some people I'd mentioned, and I just got a lot of energy from the gig, and it just, you know, it's just really good. It's something I needed.
Well, I saw Steel Wheels tour. Gosh, that's been 15 years ago, probably. Just guessing. And they were phenomenal. I mean,
Bill Wyman was still the bassist, and he's sort of the secret weapon that people forget because he sometimes plays bass guitar like a lead instrument, and he really propelled the group. And when you have a rhythm section of Charlie Watts and Bill Wyman, your bass and drum axis, something goes on there that's mysterious and sexual and just so pocket locked that, you know, it just keeps it all going. And, you know, I've interviewed Bill over the years and all that, and he always thought the secret of the Stones was the way him and Charlie had it together. And when they're moving together, everything else kind of revolves around them. It's a little different trip with Daryl Jones on bass. He plays a different sort of bass, too. I mean, actual instrument bass than Bill. But, you know, it's a lot of fun.
You know, and Daryl probably caught a lot of grief when he joined the Stones, because I can remember when he played with Sting that all the musicians went, and Marsalis said, "Why are you getting away from the jazz? Why aren't you playing? What are you playing rock for?" Well, I think it made a big difference.
You know, I've been in some recording sessions with him. I mean, you know, because he had played with Miles Davis and then played with Sting and joined the Rolling Stones. But, you know, he's from Chicago. He grew up around blues. It all seems rather logical to me. But, you know, once you defect from jazz to rock and roll and you're a high-profile person, you know, you're going to, you know, there's always going to be haters.
Sure there is. And when we
get
back to Bill, go ahead.
Love Bill Wyman.
Yeah.
I like hearing the Woodstock tune open your show, because that bass is by a guy named Greg Reeves, who's hardly ever talked about. Unless Steve Stills played bass on the track, if I think about it, maybe he doubled himself. But that Woodstock tune holds up really well.
Oh, that's great music. I mean, that's, to me, that was one of their great, great songs. It just kicked butt from the moment the first guitar riff.
Well, they recorded it in Hollywood at a place called Wally Hyder's, and it was engineered by a guy named Bill Halverson, who had been involved with the Monterey Pop Festival, but he also oversaw and engineered the 1968 live Cream album, Wheels of Fire.
Oh, yeah.
So we are always reminded, and it's a secret weapon that I do in all the writing I do. It used to be a liability for 30 years, but I make it a point to speak to the engineers. I always have been engineer-centric, although I'm not a guy that sits there and writes for all kinds of technical magazines and all that. I mean, I had something published 30 years ago once in Mix Magazine. But I was always engineer. I wanted to find out about the room tone and the spacing of microphones and the space and how – and nobody was ever interested in talking to the engineers. They don't – and what happened for about 30 years, I would always have engineers quoted in my articles, and 90% of the time editors would cut them out. They didn't think they were sexy enough or who cared because everybody was so lead singer-centric. Now it's starting to happen since we've read the same stories about the same seven people for 30, 40, or 50 years, that if you bring something new to the game, talk to the engineer or second engineer or an arranger or a session guy or somebody did a vocal overdub or a percussionist, I mean, I'm finding out that stuff isn't getting isn't getting trimmed from my articles anymore, and the fan mail I get or the email stuff or whatever you want to call it or when people come up to me, they're really happy that I'm, you know, can mention the name Bill Halverson and stuff like that because we're in a society that has got a little bit of celebrity disease.
It does.
And we need to know about the people on the side or behind the scenes. At least that's my theory, and I don't know. I don't know if the word is, you know, I mean, that's how I'm looking at it these days.
I think they're far more interesting to talk to a lot of times than the actual artists. Because when we listen to the Beatles, and if you've ever heard any studio stuff from the Beatles before the, you know, the final mix and everything, you realize how important George Martin and his staff were to those recordings.
Well, you know, I'm just currently working on this piece that I'm going to unleash, because I said to myself just this week, and I just kind of come from the Charles Bukowski school, I write and then I send the stuff out. 90% of the time there's no assignment for it. I write and I send it out there. When I was younger, I'd probably go 1 for 300 submissions.
Oh, wow.
Then it was like 1 out of 100. I mean, that ate up months and years of time, but I built up an archive.
Sure.
And I didn't become bitter about rejections and all that, or I wouldn't be able to function on the phone today. But I decided, okay, we're in July. What's going to be the next huge rock and roll story that I think everybody's going to be writing about next year? It's kind of like the way Mark Jackson played for the Indiana team. You've got to anticipate the fourth quarter when you're in the first quarter. You have to look down the game. And I said to myself, well, in February of 64, the Beatles arrived in America to do the Ed Sullivan Show and to play a show in Washington, D.C. They'd already been on the Jack Parr Show earlier. And I said, let me go write about the Beatles. How about an article called It Was 50 Years Ago Today?
Oh,
and
man.
I'm writing about it right now, anticipating that everybody's going to do all these Beatles stories. And by the way, you can steal my idea out there, anybody who's listening. I'm just spreading the music, okay?
Sure.
I'm not territorial. I am, as Horace Tapscott told us, to be collaborative, not competitive. So go do it. But the thing is, I made it a point the last 20 years to talk to whatever Beatle engineers would come to town or I could track down at Abbey Road.
Mm-hmm.
I made it a point to speak to Berry Gordy of Motown or Dick Clark, who's not with us physically, and ask him about the Beatles, anticipating this 10 years ago, and getting back to the engineer thing. So I even wanted to know about how the Beatles records were mastered that we're getting, you know, on digital or on CDs.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably spent 50 years researching this piece, you know, psychically, but I'm really got something interesting. And then I said to myself, what's the one thing about the Beatles we never read about because they've been so chronicled? And I was fortunate to meet all four of them and interview a couple of them over the years. What do we need to know about the Beatles that we don't know about? Since everybody's going to be jumping on this 50th, you know, landing of the Beatles invade America, you know, you're going to be seeing all this.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, you know, I seem to remember the first airplay for the Beatles happened actually in Canada. And I tracked down a journalist and a writer named Gary Pigold from Toronto, although he now lives in New Jersey. And he kind of verified to me that there was some initial airplay in as early as 1963 in England, long before the Ed Sullivan booking and all that kind of stuff, although the show was booked 6 months in advance. But and I talked to him and interviewed him about the Beatles' relationship to Canada. And then this kind of comes from another Indiana man, my acquaintance. I had, you know, Coach John Wooden, who I knew, who's from Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And so after I talked to Gary about the Beatles in Canada, and I realized I'm on to something here. They got their first airplay there because there was a big resistance of the Beatles getting airplay in America. America was, and to some extent still is, kind of a very xenophobic country. And then I went to the market, and I ran into Burton Cummings of the Guess Who, another Canadian, although he's mm-hmm. been living in California for 30 years. And I said, you know, he's an old friend of mine. I used to interview him when he was in the Guess Who. And I said, I got to ask you a question. He said, yeah, what do you want to know? And I said, the English Invasion and the Beatles were really big in England from Jump Street, right? And he said, you have no idea. Nobody ever asked me this.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, prove it to me about the English Invasion and the Beatles, why it made such an impact on you, besides everybody loved the Beatles and he started a band called the Devrons before, you know, everybody wanted to be in a band, etc. And he said, well, you know, when I go on my solo tours across Canada, I end my show on piano and do a version of Jerry and the Pacemakers' Ferry Across the Mersey.
Wow.
And he said, that's the kind of impact impact the Beatles and the initial English invasion had on Canada. And so I'm putting that in this article. Now, the good thing is, I do this for myself. I think I'm going to find a market for it.
Sure.
And I just can't wait till everybody types and coughs, you know, takes my trip and will give you, every article will be Ed Sullivan, but guess what? I just interviewed the owner of the Ed Sullivan Estate and Archives. I got the definitive Sullivan interview and have all the goodies. And so I'm just going to go throw it out there and I don't know. I just throw it out there. I may get a car out of this, or I may get 20 rejections. Who knows? This is what I do. I really don't know. You know, as Dennis Dragon says, we don't define it. We just do it. I'm sorry I'm rambling tonight. I realize people are listening, but, you know, you asked a question.
I know.
You know me. I don't live by filter.
No, you don't. Well, you know what's interesting.
So, anyways, I'm in a big Beatles thing right now, but if you're going to, you know, as Keith Richards said, if you are going to do a cover of a song or do a rendition of a tune, then you got to do it differently.
Sure.
So if you're going to write about the Beatles, at least I have enough archive quotes from, like, you know, George Harrison and things like that. But getting back to the engineer thing, I just didn't want to speak to the living engineers. I wanted to speak to the mastering engineers and some of the people in production and really find out the sonic magic of their music. And I think I found some really good stuff to write about, and we'll see what everybody's going to say, because again, we became very celebrity driven and lead singer driven and star soaked, and
yeah.
I've decided to go against that a little bit and even go deeper in the engineers or talk to a record company executive or talk to somebody. I just interviewed John Van Hammersfeld, an album cover artist of 50 years. He used to work at Capitol. You may know his classic image, The Endless Summer. You might have seen that wonderful poster he's done. But
mm-hmm.
he helped design the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour album for
mm-hmm.
the American market. And just being able to kind of talk to somebody who actually was involved putting together original Beatles cover, it was kind of cool. And I'm only just trying to do, I'm in this game for the knowledge. When I was younger, it was a liability because people didn't know what to do with the data. Now that things are progressing, and sorry, kids, you can't get this all off Wikipedia. You had to be there.
Well,
oh, my, yeah. isn't he cocky tonight.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I always say we grew up in a great era, and in fact, I remember reading where George was in the United States in 63 to visit his sister, and he went to a record
shop. Absolutely, and I had a correspondence with Louise Harrison, and I met her.
Oh, you did?
And, yeah, she was married to an American fella, as she told me, who might have been in the military, I'm not sure. And she lived in St. Louis, and her younger brother George came over in 63, and it might have only been a six-week visit, and it was before the Beatles came over, and he jammed at a club, but what was important about that is he got to listen to American radio, and hear people like Chuck Berry, you know, on AM radio, and I'm not saying that that had a huge influence, but when you have that person that does the expedition, it's sort of like George Harrison was the Beatles' wingman.
He was.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
Saying he really scouted the place, heard American radio, caught the television,
yeah.
And reported back. And I have a feeling it led to some of the Motown Jobette copyrights that were done that were hits at the time in 63, you know, the Marvelettes and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And Louise and I had a very nice chat and took a photo with a friend of mine. And she was very proud of that, and she was a very, avid supporter of her younger brother, George.
I'll bet.
And, in fact, it's a really funny story, but when I met her at my one and only Beatle convention that I went to, and I said, you know, I've always dug George. I've interviewed him. I wanted to tell you, Louise, that and Louise used to do radio interviews on a radio station, KRLA in L.A., during the height of Beatlemania, because she wrote columns about my brother George. She really was into promoting him and just being a sister of a Beatle and helping promote it. And I said, you know, I always dug the fact that, you know, George is born February 25th, and I was born February 26th, and I kind of thought, you know, when I was a kid in elementary school and as a teenager, or even now, I guess I'm still a teenager, that, you know, I had a birthday, like, you know, right next to George Harrison, and I'm with my friend Tom Johnson, and I said, you know, I was just happy that he was another Pisces. And she said to me, let me tell you something. He was really born on February 26th. I was there.
Oh.
And I said, what are you talking about? I got a half a dozen Beatle books, and, I mean, I know the birthday. And he said, no, I was 8 years old in the Liverpool hospital, and I was waiting to see if I was going to have, you know, a baby brother or baby sister, and I was in the ward with my family. And my mother, meaning her mother, went into labor on February 25th, but he wasn't born until the morning of February 26th. But in those days, you started the paperwork 6, 8, or 14 hours earlier.
Oh.
She said, he was born on February 26th, young man. And I turned to Tom Johnson and I said, is Alan Funt going to show up on some candid camera level? You know, I mean, are you kidding? She said, no, he's February 26th, although, you know, because we used to get all the gifts from all the fans. And then I thought that was rather remarkable. And then I didn't go on the internet or anything, but I met a couple of Beatle people, including a guy, it's funny, a guy named Ron Landau, big Beatles fan, friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And I met him, and he said, to me, you're born February 26th. I said, yeah. And he said, yeah, I'm born February 25th. I said, that's cool. He said, oh, man, George Harrison was really born on the 26th. That pissed me off. Because for 30 years he thought he had George Harrison's birthday. And he said, no, there's finally some book that kind of talks about this. So anyways, let me give you the capper of the story. I'm not name dropping, but...
Go ahead.
I got to connect with George about a year or so before he died, I'd interviewed him because I had done a Ravi Shankar interview, went to Ravi's house, and I interviewed George largely about Ravi Shankar, and he said, you can ask a Beatle question. So we talked a little bit about the Beatles. And I was at somebody's house, and he came over, and we kind of connected. And I said, I want to show you something. And I took out my wallet, and I handed him my driver's license. And he looked at it, and he just started laughing when he saw the February 26th thing. And I said, you know, your sister told this. And it was sort of like, oh, that's the big secret. So I said, well, I guess I'm where I'm supposed to be. Anybody got something to drink? So that's kind of my little Beatles thing. So I've been kind of Beatled out, even though I'm kind of a Stones guy.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of thinking what the next real gig could be with me. And luckily, due to, I don't know what it is, I'm on the planet to kind of be there for the inception of the Beatles, you know, audio arrival.
Mm-hmm.
And to be here a half a century later to at least, you know, make an attempt in chronicling it. So I'm a very fortunate person. I don't take any of this for granted, but I'm going to be bringing some pretty interesting stuff, you know, to the print game, either in a magazine or online. And, you know, I like the Beatles a lot. The records hold up good. It's just right now I'm just kind of listening to them differently now. Now I'm listening a bit more to Ringo's drumming, or I just will focus on John's rhythm guitar. You know, sometimes we start doing that when you've been exposed to something so often. You know, sometimes, like even, you know, in your case, going to maybe a Pacers basketball game, maybe you'll just watch a guard for 5 minutes instead of the whole game. You start focusing on some specifics, and you learn a lot doing that as well.
Well, especially now when they put them on CD, you can hear every instrument so clearly, where before it was like a wall of sound, which was phenomenal. I say that there was nothing like listening to the original Beatles 45s on a really good hi-fi in those days in 1964.
Well, I have to tell you, in my next book that's out next year, it's kind of an examination of the music of Los Angeles and the disc jockeys of this town, 1956 to 1972. I had a really fascinating interview with a guy named Bill Inglot. You may know his name. It's on dozens and dozens of albums. He's a mastering engineer for many years, you know, kind of involved in restoring and preparing, you know, albums that were once vinyl that come out on CD for reissue.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me the thing about vinyl, there's romance involved with the needle, whether it be a little bit of the distortion, the tracking, the harshness, you know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
There's a romantic aspect of placing a needle on a vinyl record, and maybe that's, you know, reinforces what you just told me. So
yeah.
I'm you know, and I've been studying you know, if it's called studying, to me it's not studying, it's called living. But, I mean, I couldn't ignore this. It was on the front page of the paper last week. I think in the last year, and it might be this decade, sales for vinyl albums are at $171 million.
Wow.
People are buying vinyl records, largely
yep.
reissues, mono stuff, or bands just putting out things on vinyl. I mean, Greg Franco was on your show a few weeks ago from Rough Church, and next
mm-hmm.
week he's got a new record, which is a double LP only.
Wow.
On vinyl. So mm-hmm. I'm watching this kind of vinyl renaissance, for lack of a better word, and what it's doing, it's putting the focus on, you know, classic or legendary albums that are 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 years old. And that's sort of in my wheelhouse, because I've kind of been monitoring and buying, you know, I mean, I think I have so many Doors albums in about 8 different configurations. I mean, yesterday I found an 8-track cartridge of Jethro Tull's Stand Up album.
Oh,
I mean,
my.
I, you know, and I didn't really dig 8-tracks because there were no liner notes. But,
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting to follow the migration of of the recordings, not just reissues, greatest hits, live albums, that you can follow it from the demos now to the original recordings to stereo mono. It's, you know, we're starting to see different little secret tunnels behind these original records. But the good thing is rock and roll is now 60 or 70 years old. If you're going back to 1951 or Ike Turner and or Rocket 88 or something like that, at least, you know, 63 years old, 62, whatever, or Elvis Presley, if you want to trace it to him, 1954, 5, or 6. Whatever it is, we're past the half-century mark of rock and roll as an art form,
mm-hmm.
and the good stuff lasts, and it's now cross-generational, and I'm very happy about that because I've devoted a life to taking this very seriously, and for a long time, people thought it was some kind of hobby or kibitz for me, but I'm a real student of this game, and that's why some of the musical greats have always embraced me, either summoning me to their sessions or come to our shows, because I'm really not interested. Oh, sure, I want to know about their personal lives, and I find out all that good stuff anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to kind of know about, do you use a pick? Do you use, what kind of gauge are your strings? And I don't even own a guitar, and I ask these questions. I'm just trying to find out about how the stuff is made. And I think that stuff shows up in my books, too. People know they're getting some really deep-rooted, you know, womb journey when, you know, they come on my ride.
That's right. Our guest tonight, Harvey Kubernick, we're going to take a short break. Folks, you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters.
It's Bobcat, Abby. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
We will be back with Harvey Kubernick in just a few moments. We want to remind everyone that next week on the program, it's a dandy, from the National Geographic series Beast Hunter, Pat Spain will be joining us. We'll be talking about his worldwide adventures as he's basically looked into some of the reports of what we call cryptozoology, animals or beasts that have been sighted by people in different parts of the world. to see if there's any integrity at all to the reports. And next week's going to be a truly outstanding program with Pat Spain. I also want to thank McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado. We call it God's country, everybody. If you've never been out west to the Rockies, you're really missing out. We encourage you to do so. And what a great place to stay, McGregor Mountain Lodge, right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. From your cabin, you'll have a view of extraordinary Rocky Mountains, including the massive Deer Mountain. There'll be bighorn sheep in your backyard, elk. It's absolutely phenomenal. Go to their website, www.mcgregormountainlodge.com. And we also still want to remind everyone about our brand-new Facebook page, Larry Batson's Wild World. Hit the like button. We want as many as we can on that page. Find out about our shows that are coming up, shows from the past that you can still listen to in the archives on Blog Talk Radio. They make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on this wonderful network we call Blog Talk Radio.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. The time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
Extraordinary Sounds of the Doors from 1967, I believe. Is that right,
Harvey?
Hey,
you were playing the long version off an album, obviously.
Well, that's
that
what
wasn't
we do.
The edited 45 cut. Very good.
Oh, we know that. We try to be.
And by the way, I realize we went on a Beatles Jones, but you know what? It is an animal show, so that all made sense, doesn't it?
Well, perfect.
You know, absolutely.
Right, well, anyways, thank you for playing the Doors. What can I tell you? We don't have 10 hours for me to hawk you a Chinook about them, but you know, very band very close to my heart.
Harvey,
well, and that song was written by Robbie, the guitar player. And
primarily, yes, absolutely. And as Ray Manzarek of the band used to say, Robbie was our secret weapon because he wrote a lot of songs, you know, whether it be Wishful, Sinful, and things like that,
mm-hmm.
largely by himself. And he's kind of overlooked a little bit as a principal songwriter in the band. The focus, again, is largely on Morrison or Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
But that song really works. And it's just, you know, nice to hear Ray Manzarek play.
Oh, that organ run is fantastic. That's always that made you love that song the very first moment you heard it.
Harvey, have you heard about the lizard that has been named after Morrison?
Is it like a takeoff of the Lizard King or something, or is there actually a reptile named after him?
There's
mm-hmm.
a 40 million year old extinct lizard that honors Jim Morrison. Its name is Barbaturex morrisoni. And the
really? Somebody registered that? How interesting.
Yes.
Well, 10 points for Dr. Day and his staff.
Man, I guess everything all bleeds into each other.
My goodness.
That's right.
Now, you were talking
well,
about
they didn't,
Harvey.
They didn't call him the lizard. They didn't call him the Lizard King for nothing, did they?
That's right.
That's true.
I guess if you could actually sing something called Celebration of the Lizard, and
mm-hmm.
then later there's, you know, a reptile kind of acknowledged as your imprint, I guess that's called Full Circle.
I would feel honored. he has to feel honored, his spirit.
He would, too. He was a student of anthropology. He'd like all that.
Oh, absolutely. So you were involved with a television program that was nominated for an Emmy. We wanted to be sure and talk about that.
Yeah, it was. There's a show in Los Angeles on the ABC channel called INLA, and they did an hour profile and study of the musical legacy of Laurel Canyon, the producers Tina Mulavey, and it was just nominated in the entertainment category for an Emmy. The awards are announced August 3rd. I mean, I'm not a member of any of this kind of stuff, but it was really important. It was a really good study of Laurel Canyon's history because, you know, Johnny Echols of Love was filmed, Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees, Gail Zappa on behalf of Frank Zappa was lensed, I was on the show, and all kinds of kind of rare archive footage and pictures. And the show made such an impact, it was shown four times.
Wow.
In 2012 and 2013. And when I first got the call to participate and be the lead consultant, and it's a show that was influenced by my book on Laurel Canyon, Canyon of Dreams, The Magic Music of Laurel Canyon, and inspired a bit by it, but I mean, it wasn't optioned or anything. But I said to the producer, Tina, if you do this right, you'll get an Emmy nomination, so let's just go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was a very interesting historical kind of profile of the region and the characters and the music and some of the myths and all that kind of stuff and the fun the girls and the boys had in the area. And I always know that once television comes into the frame, things happen, and I didn't expect three or four reruns and all kinds of social media about this stuff, but I just know that the music and the territory and also the lore of Hollywood always gets people in heat, from the media to the viewers. People, this is sort of everybody's kind of secret thing. Everybody wants to know about the Doors or the Mothers of Invention or the Monkees beyond just hearing the tunes on an oldies radio station, because
sure,
they came of age to this stuff. I mean, people like you and I were fortunate to have seen Jimi Hendrix perform.
Mm-hmm.
This is not lost on me or you. We've never been the same since we saw that guy do his trip.
Nope.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, that's the way I feel about it.
Absolutely.
So are we going into overtime tonight? I'm just curious.
Yes, but we are.
Good. So anyways, I'm really happy about the show, and it came out okay. And I went on full trust, you know, with Tina, who was a stranger. She had seen my book, and, you know, and we're all getting a lot of dividends off the show. The visibility, it turned into people calling me from France and Germany and Australia and you know, and various documentaries and stuff like that. And so, and also my book came out in paperback in 2012. So it's really, you know, it's really spiked sales and just caused all kinds of, you know, excitement around the title. So I'm just think if somebody had never heard some of the music of Laurel Canyon or discovered the Doors beyond Light My Fire and get into sort of the deep catalog aspect of the band, they may hear something really enticing or different, and then the you know, the thread kind of continues.
Well, Laurel Canyon was kind of the centerpiece of the music world from the, what, 66, 67 to 72 or 3?
That's longer. That's the general window of a lot of, there were beatniks and poets and sculptors and filmmakers and actors in the 40s and 50s in Laurel Canyon, when it usually had hunting lodges there. Then in the 50s, people started building houses in the area. And around 63 and 64, folk musicians moved in. And about 65 or 66, the rock and roll people moved in there, because you could rent a band house for $200 a month and have three or four people there. That was the rent at $200 a month back then. And you could rehearse there, plus I mentioned it in my Laurel Canyon book, but you know, one of the reasons why things happened up there, it wasn't heavily police surveyed. There was a security system of two people on a bicycle called West Tech Security, because the sheriffs and the police and all the craziness was a mile down the street on Hollywood Boulevard or Sunset Strip. So they kind of left the canyon people alone. Mm-hmm. And your window about 63, 64 to 1972 or 1973 is totally accurate. I mean, I pointed this out in my Canyon of Dreams book, and in my next book, I'm referencing it again. But one of the reasons things kind of changed in Laurel Canyon, although believe me, from Slash to members of Marilyn Manson, you know, there's still a lot of Linkin Park, a lot of musicians live in Laurel Canyon again now. Many people that are all platinum sellers. You just don't really hear about it. But what kind of changed around 1972 is there was an earthquake in Southern California in February of 1971. And it was pretty scary. And even though I lived 2 miles from Laurel Canyon, you know, as a teenager when that happened, it's a pretty scary thing when your chimney collapses next to you, or look at the, or you look, and I talked to John Densmore of the Doors about this in the Canyon of Dreams book. Some of those houses in Laurel Canyon were built on stilts. And he was married to a Texas woman at the time, and she said, honey, we get, you know, hurricanes in Texas all the time. But, I mean, people were jumping out of those houses. And so what happened after the 1971 earthquake, a lot of people put their houses up for sale, and by 1972 or 1973, they were out of the neighborhood. And then a whole new batch of, you know, people moved in there. So the earthquake had a lot to do with it, but it's never discussed. You know, natural disasters are never discussed in Hollywood. I sadly have seen a lot of things from the 1963 Baldwin Hills flood, which was pretty scary. I used to live in Baldwin Hills. There was a Bel Air fire in 60 and 61 in a kind of an affluent part of town where I think 450 houses went down. There was a Laurel Canyon fire in 59. It was the first time these kind of caterpillar things were used, you know. And then there was the 1971 earthquake, and then there was the 1994 earthquake. These are the things that have changed the complexion of the city, the, you know, region, neighborhood, and of course the music and the art made of the community. It's not anything you see on reality television or the things that are broadcast to the world, you know, in movies and TVs from this town. People just don't like to know there are real disasters in Hollywood because it ruins their fantasy.
Yeah. And
Of course,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying they like the movies and the blockbusters and all this Armageddon film stuff coming out from here. I don't think those people have ever had chimneys collapsed on them or been in houses on stilts where you're swaying 150 feet, you know, over shrubbery. So, you know, so Hollywood is an interesting community. What can I tell you? What were you going to say?
Well, I was getting ready to say now, of course, Laurel Canyon is the home of Jimmy Steinfeld, rock and roll photographer extraordinaire.
Yeah, he's done your show. That's right.
Yes.
And he's got a studio actually in Laurel Canyon, and I've been there, and I wrote the introduction for his first book of photography that came out, I guess, over a year ago.
Yeah. When we were talking earlier,
I mean, I'll always support, you know, the artists of the community. And, you know, his book is a pretty interesting book because one of the reasons, you know, I got involved with his book is that it wasn't a journey through the 60s or the 70s, which is a lot of the things that come my way. He started taking pictures maybe as early as 1984, so it was photos of the last 20 or 25 years, you know, and it had everybody from Prince to Madonna to Michael Jackson. And so it wasn't your usual Laurel Canyon book. And so that, you know, intrigued me a bit. because I like to leave this domain once in a while, or at least this era that I've. It's not quicksand or quagmire. I've been doing this voluntarily, but you know the real secret is I'm finally getting to write the books now that I tried to do for the last 10, 20, or 30 years. So I just kind of want to get them out of me before I really hop into this current century and really get into future space, which I'm intending to do. But then again, I know that I'm bringing something new to the information and the data, and I'm not recycling the same 60s and 70s vision. I mean, I know that doing it, and there's enough people and consumers and fans and whatever you want to call it, media support, that, you know, are applauding the efforts. So I kind of see where it's all going. And so that's why I encourage the Jim Steinfelds and some of the new canyon dwellers, because they're actually chronicling a new Laurel Canyon that has nothing to do with the monkeys or Love or Joni Mitchell or any of that. And, you know, although I will tell you, as Slash in his book, and Slash grew up in Laurel Canyon. And so you get, yeah, so you get a little bit of this crossover, but, you know, I go so far back with him. Every time I see him, I call him Saul. You know, I know him as Saul Hudson because we knew his mother, Ola Hudson, who had a clothing store in the 70s and used to do clothes for Carol King and Joni Mitchell. And his father worked for Geffen Records very early on. And so, you know, I remember him at age 8, 10, and 12 on a bicycle and stuff like that. And and so he gets a big kick, you know, when we talk or email, and I'll go, "Hey, Saul." Not that he hides his name, but this Slash name, which the actor Seymour Cassell gave to him, it's just, you know, you have to have one of those names in that racket that he's in.
Sure.
And it works for him too. And he's a really a terrific guy. I like him a lot, and he made it a point to be in my Laurel Canyon book, even though he was defined by Guns N' Roses and that kind of wild metal world. He wanted to talk about going to a Carole King recording session at A&M that his mother took him to. That was a very pivotal moment in his life that he went to see Carole King record. And he also said in my Laurel Canyon book, nobody sang like Minnie Riperton, who lived, you know, in Laurel Canyon. Actually, is the mother of the actress comedian Maya Randolph from Saturday Night, you know, Live. And so you don't associate Carole King, Joni Mitchell, or Minnie Riperton with Slash. But in the Harvey Kubernick journey, that's the stuff that I bring to the table. I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, some bodacious braggart, but the thing is, I know that I'm bringing some new, you know, steps to the dance, and I know the kind of impression it makes on people, just like you'd never put those names together with Slash, would you?
No.
But then again, I went to Fairfax High, and he briefly went to Fairfax High, so, you know, we both went to the same school at different time periods, so we're both pretty damaged, what can I tell you?
Well, you know what I hate to say, though, Harvey, is I don't think the current crop of artists will be nearly as interesting as the ones that we grew up with.
Why?
I don't know. I think the artists in our era, they had to do the club scene longer. There wasn't the advantage of social media where they could put out their own recording and put it on Facebook, and within a day, 10,000 people are going to hear it. You know, I think the amount of work they had to put into it gives them more character.
Well, you know, I'll let you in on not a little secret, but in my Beatle research, and it extends to so many other layers to maybe try to answer your question. By the time the Beatles came to America and performed live in this country in February 64, it's estimated that they had played 400 sets of music, including a couple of different stints in Hamburg at 4, 5, or 6 sets a night. So you were seeing people that had done, not only came to America with the number one record, but had done 5 years or, you know, maybe 4 years or 3.5 years, if you want to call it, or 3 years maybe, of hard road work, tours, opening slots, Hamburg, you name it. And so that's one of it. And then also, and Kim Fowley and I discussed this, and it's in my next book about songs. In the older days, composers wrote 100 or 200 songs and threw out, 90% of them. 100 you never heard, 50 were never finished. I mean, the craft was beyond 6 months or a year of, okay, let's have a band, let's form a band in high school and aim for, people are very media savvy now, and I think, people, I know it sounds corny to say the journey is what it's about and all that kind of stuff, but, everything is at a very quick pace right now, and nobody really wants to put in, the 10,000 hours or the 20,000 hours, like the author Malcolm talks about. And, I also think another theory is, and very few people discuss, but even current bands now, they're always seeking out vintage equipment, Fenders from 1967 and Beatle Vox amps. And I think the equipment had a lot to do with the actual sound we heard on the records. But then again, I have another theory, and it's fortified by a guy named John Wood, who's a friend of mine, and John Wood's father, Randy Wood, owned the immortal record label Dot Records, which had 37 million sellers from the, Green Door, Jim Lowe, to Lawrence Welk, to Pat Boone, to Wipeout, surf music. And he claimed that things changed when the world stopped recording in two-track, direct-to-two-track. So the advent of the 8-track machine in about 1968, and then people having 16 tracks and 24 tracks. I mean, now people are making records. They're not even in the same room anymore, let alone the same country through Skype or something. So records are being made different, and I understand that's evolution, that's economic streams. There's always nepotism, politics, and all these factors that inform any deal that happens. But I don't know. It's one of the reasons my next book out next year studies the 1956 to 1972 world of Los Angeles music and the radio DJs, and largely an AM radio world, which we all kind of grew up through, Boss Radio or the RKO chain. The records kind of leapt out of the radio. I think he had to work a little harder to get a record label contract in, or they let a few weirdos and cooties in. They let some really unique, non-affiliated talent in to get deals, and therefore you had a few oddballs and weirdos and mavericks and very hungry artists getting opportunities, and I don't think that exists as much now. Although there's a lot of interesting new music being made, I try to study some of it. I listen to a disc jockey out here named Rodney Bingenheimer, Rodney on the Rock, who plays nothing but new music, I don't know, maybe 90 minutes a week max. And I'm not big on synthesizers and all that sort of stuff, but or EDM, but I understand that world is out there. And but lyrically, I think the songs really spoke to us, in the period I'm telling you about. But then again, there's many people who can say the music of today, they're flipping out on, Alabama Shakes or whatever, too. So it's out there for everybody. But I think people really had to pay harder dues back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s.
Oh, absolutely.
And with the advent of punk rock or new wave, whatever, often it was, not often, but some of the time it was attitude and connections over musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
However, if it's about communication, a lot of that stuff communicated. Luckily, we had about 60 or 80 years of good blues and R&B music, at least till, you know, the start of the century, and that stuff holds up really well. In fact, you had Leon Huff on your radio show of Gamble and Huff.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes, we did.
I mean, listen. What can I tell you? You had Dee Dee Sharp on your show. You've had Dave Davies of the Kinks on your show. You've had Al Jardine of the Beach Boys. I mean, just say to yourself, you had a Beach Boy, a Kink, Dee Dee Sharp who sang Mashed Potatoes, and one of Gamble, Huff of Gamble and Huff, who gave you the Philly soul sound, and go all the way back to Patti LaBelle, etc. I mean, there's something about the artists you speak to that just have something that the people today, I don't know, I don't believe in voting for music and American Idol and The Voice. I don't live in that world. Bobby Bradford said about American Idol, a jazz musician, they were the highest paid karaoke singers. So, mazel tov to everybody. If that's how you want to get over, fantastic. Get a record deal, sing a cover song, go out on an arena tour. I think it's great. Everybody make money. It's fantastic. It's America. I'm all for all of it. I'm happy Smokey Robinson and Jimmy Iovine and my pal, Little Steven are seen by millions of people. I think it's all great. I'm a little concerned about the people that don't get heard, who don't get opportunities, who will never be heard, those are the feelings I have. And so I try in my books to go a little deeper than just the people who've charted, or had top 10 records. And again, I bring in the concept of the arranger or the engineer or the one hit wonders and all that. And it's a big world. There's everything for everybody. Fantastic. Go sing a Motown song. Go get a record deal. I'm all for it. I'm glad Berry Gordy's on Broadway. I think it's great to see just how huge music and rock and roll and legacy music or heritage artists or whatever you want to deem it are out there making money and working and are employed. I think it's wonderful because I'm planning to do the same thing.
Oh, man.
I'm available.
I know. Our guest tonight's been Harvey Kubernick. Gosh, Harvey, what a great hour and 18 minutes. What a show, Dr. Day.
No kidding. I mean, as much as music is a big part of our life, I'm so glad that Harvey's decided to round up some of the ingredients and the history, to let us know how these things were put together. And
I really think that's probably the key thing. Like, just, everybody should give 110% in anything they do, because that extra 10% makes a big difference, I've learned. Didn't call this guy, I had a hunch about the Beatles in Canada. And if I didn't know, an engineer or a co-engineer ends up being a producer one day, I just kind of want to find out about the songwriters and how things worked. And hopefully we'll reach some world where these end of the earth movies and all this chaos stuff can kind of chill out a little bit. And some of the new vision, or as Deepak Chopra talked to me about, the cultural creatives could get a little bit more action. I'm a guy born in Hollywood or on the border of East Hollywood in L.A., so I don't need anybody to tell me about Hollywood. I've been here, for 60 years, okay? But I've seen the movies, okay? And I know actors and directors. I mean, I did a whole book on soundtracks and music supervisors 10 years ago. I don't quite understand, and I would never tell anybody they're not allowed to do anything. You want to have 25 reality shows? Do whatever you want. I enjoy all of it because I know for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Still, I wonder about this trend or all this stuff about Armageddon and these end-of-the-world movies. I just think, I'd like a little sensitivity. And I know we don't really ever talk about politics and it's not that kind of show, but can I just say something that I'm appalled by the cover of the new Rolling Stone?
I was going to ask you about that.
I mean, I don't subscribe to that magazine or paper. I never have.
Mm-hmm.
And they reviewed my Monterey Pop book, and I know a couple of the writers there. But I'm ashamed. I don't know, as an author, music journalist, somebody who's on year 43 of writing, I don't really think we need a calf cake photo or a picture of whatever that bomber person's name is on the cover of Rolling Stone. Or if you show him on the cover, do what they did to Jim Morrison and show him in handcuffs and chains being arrested.
Yeah.
I just don't, I mean, show us the consequences of what I think were the actions. And I'm just in shock that I don't read the magazine. Maybe it was a very good research piece talking to this guy's high school friends. I'm just actually in shock to see a magazine that once had its finger on the pulse, I think, of social change or obligation of examination,
mm-hmm.
where there's a, I don't even want to say, like a Tiger Beat type photo of this monster.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm actually ashamed, if I'm even in this profession, that I don't know if it has an effect on, well, it must be, because I'm seeing it all over the news and people are as upset as I am, and I'm sure you must be amazed since you remember when that magazine first started. But I mean, when follow this one, and Ram Dass stresses to honor the incarnation. Mm-hmm. Well, when your magazine is named after, I believe, a Muddy Waters song, like where the Stones might have gotten the name, where they were the Rolling Stones. If your magazine is named after a McKinley Morganfield song, Muddy Waters, I really don't... Muddy Waters' life and trek was the antithesis of what was on the cover, or is on the cover, of this new Rolling Stone. And I just don't think somebody who might have done this act, I don't know the facts, I don't follow this stuff, I it seems like he's the guy, but that's not for me to say, as the Johnny Mathis song goes. But I mean, can we have a little sensitivity visually about if you're going to profile these assassins and people, show the repercussions of their trip, or show the possibility of their journey. It just seemed to be like it was, they went out of their way to make this guy, unless I'm reading it wrong, kind of a pop star image. Is that correct?
That's the way I read it.
Well, it's too bad.
Aren't you disappointed?
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
The word.
I was mad. Do we want kids thinking that they can be terrorists and then become, you know, on a popular magazine?
Well, I mean, I know, you know, I'm just, if that's what you need to get visibility on the news rack, go for it, dude. But I mean, I don't like the signal that sends. But then again, I'm not a branding expert or a marketer. But I'm just saying, I will say one thing. When I saw that cover, and it was just flashed on television, and I saw people, you know, in discussion on it constantly, I'm just so glad who I am and what I do and what I write about And you know, since we've talked about my books before, you know that the visuals and the photos I pick for my books and articles are a big part, you know, of the path that the reader connects with. And I'm just so glad my take as a guy from Rolling Stone or a Rolling Stone or a guy that's just on the pebble trek of life. You know, I'm not going to try to do things like that for quick attention or quick bucks or flash or coverage, but I sure got exposure. But I mean, what a signal to send out. I don't have the time to go online and read the debates and op-ed. I don't do any of that stuff, you know. But I mean, certainly you guys are in Indiana and I'm on the West Coast here. And can we have a little more sensitivity about things like that? I shudder to think what the victims of Boston think when they see that paraded.
Well, if you look on the internet, they have what they call the uncensored pictures of the Boston bombings. And after you look at those photographs of these people that are terribly injured, then I think it just brings out every fiber of you anger. And to see this on Rolling Stone, it's absolutely appalling.
Yes, but, you know, it also shows you that the people in charge at Rolling Stone, and this is a byproduct of ageism that exists, you know, in the arts and in communications, that obviously there must be some people on the staff that are 20, 25, 30, and not just 60 or 65, that they have every right to think we want to portray this, I don't even want to call him a person, this way. And you know what? They're allowed to do that. It's a free country. Go right ahead. However, sometimes, you know, you shouldn't send a boy to do a man's job.
So well put.
That's
a good one.
I don't mean to down everybody out. We went from the Beatles and a bunch of love stuff to, you know, me being a Harvey Kubrick, Mister. I'm going political now for you. But I sensed that you were going to maybe ask me about this because you know that I've been in this Rolling Stone orbit, or, you know, started in music journalism only a couple of years after that magazine started, and I have a sense of shame. Luckily, these are not my comrades, and I don't know the people in charge here. It's just, this is the kink that everybody wants to do, I get it. You know, this is a society that demands exploitation. It's a visual gig out there. It's glam squads. It's Photoshop. You know, I get it. And by the way, I should say one other thing. I just find it horrific that there's references to them, to this guy reminding people of Jim Morrison. I don't know. That blew my mind. I heard it on CNN, and it's out there. And you should never compare this guy to Jim Morrison. Maybe he has brown hair or something. But, I mean, if that's the legacy of Jim Morrison, if that's the touchstone that our pundits are using or anybody uses, then they didn't really listen to the music of the Doors.
No.
All I know is I appreciate the phone call tonight. I mean, you and I have conversations. I know there's thousands of people listening and 80,000 people downloading, and I'm not here to plug product or everything. And I just, you know, I want everybody to be healthy and happy and to do their trip, and let's just try to all unite and have some concerns about the planet and the climate. And listen, it's 90 degrees in L.A. and it's 90 degrees in Indiana. It's never really like, you know, something's going on here. Can we kind of like just put a little more attention on that thing? I enjoyed myself tonight. I enjoyed myself greatly. I always support what you're doing. I felt a little sad for a while you weren't, on the dial anymore. And I'm really glad to, be with the animals and hear Crosby, Stills, and Nash and attend to the Doors, and you know, and let's just all just keep believing in the music. It's the one thing that connected us. I mean, we met because somebody I work with arranged an Al Jardine interview with you. So, I mean, somebody in the Beach Boys brought me to the attention of you and your show. So, therefore, the music connected us. And I think we should all just maybe just focus on the trail of where it can bring us and, you know, see what it leads.
Absolutely. Great show, Harvey. Gosh, such a pleasure to have you on. Next week on the show, Pat Spain. I remember, Dr. Day, when I saw Led Zeppelin in the Indianapolis Coliseum in 1970, that the manager came out after the show saying, this is the longest concert Led Zeppelin has played on their current North American tour. And, folks, this is officially, well-deservedly, the longest show we've ever done on Larry Batson's Wild World. God bless.
You mean to tell me? You mean to tell me you saw Hendrix and Zeppelin on that tour? On a tour
we'll
a couple years later? Man, I like that.
Folks, you're.
This is the longest show.
Larry Batson's
Wild World.
This
is the longest
show,
and I wouldn't have it any other way. Thank you.
Thank you,
Harvey.
Have a good.
Bye-bye.
Have a great week. We'll see you next 30. Pat Spain,
thanks,
I lost
guys.
All control.
I'll catch you. I'll catch
National
you next
Geographic
year when I'm
Magazine. Have a great week, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's
Hello.
Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.